This is NHL Radio.
Time now for NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Home Ice.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the NHL Hour. Gary Bettman here along with Phil Clement, and we are coming to you live from the NHL store powered by Reebok in Manhattan. We're on XM 204, Sirius 208. This is NHL Home Ice, and you can also get us on NHL.com. The call-in number is 1-877-NHL on XM. That's 1-877-645-6696. I guess it's been a long week. We'll get to your calls shortly, and we're going to be joined later by Senior Executive Vice President of Hockey Operations for the NHL, Coley Campbell, who will talk about the state of the game on the ice and the recently concluded general manager's meeting, which he's in charge of running. Hello, Mr. Clement.
Gary, how are you?
I'm good. I don't know why I'm tired. I just spent 3 days in Naples, Florida.
I'm assuming it wasn't sipping on pina coladas out by the pool.
Well, actually, I might feel like this if I had sipped on too many pina coladas out by the pool. But we had a good series of meetings with the managers. It's interesting. There was a lot of discussion about the fact that we moved the meetings a little bit later this year to be after the trading deadline.
Why was that?
Well, funny you should ask.
Yeah.
I was about to get to that point. The notion was that while on the one hand, getting the managers together in advance of the trading deadline might stimulate trade activity, there tends to be less focus on the meetings themselves. Not that there wasn't good focus in the past, but there would be more distractions, particularly for individual general managers, frequent leaving the room to have mini conferences or to get on the telephone. I think that the level of concentration and focus at this meeting was appreciably different than any meeting that I can remember. And as a result, I think the meetings were perhaps, in terms of the work accomplished, the discussions that were had, was perhaps the best meetings I can ever remember. It was a really solid, strong, thoughtful, professional effort by the managers.
Yeah. Is this the first meeting after the trade deadline? Had they always been right before,
yes,
leading up to the trade deadline?
That would be correct.
I can't imagine that the work would not have been better at this. I can't imagine sitting there pre-trade deadline trying to focus on one of the issues that's on the table when you're being texted that you've got a deal on the table.
Well, there you go.
You know.
They weren't exactly texting you have a deal on the table. They were talking to each other.
But even worse.
And then they were communicating back to their scouts and people who work in their hockey operations departments back in their home city. So it created more of a buzz and more of a stir as it related to the trading deadline and trades. But in terms of the real work of the general managers, which they, you know, they get together three times a year, and they're the group that's charged with being the consciousness of the game, the conscience of the game, if you will, in terms of being self-evaluative, looking at trends, and making sure they have their fingers on the pulse of the way the game is being played. You know, there's a lot of experience sitting in that room.
Tons.
Lots and lots of former players who've had spectacular careers. Lots and lots of former players who had long careers that may have been less than spectacular.
Right.
But there's a lot of hockey knowledge and experience in that room, probably incomparable for any other group that gets together at any one point to sit and talk about the game.
And that conscience really seems to be so, if not only passionate, then completely dedicated to the health of the sport. And I mean, at one time, and I've been part of the sport and watched it for years and years, there were a lot of GMs I could have looked at and said, you know what, you're only concerned with your franchise. I'm not sure that could be said about, well, any of the general managers, none that I know personally. They all seem to be so invested in the overall health of the sport and not just their own constituents in their individual franchise cities.
I think that's extremely well said. This league, this sport, has been through some challenging times, and I think part of the challenge of those times has brought everybody together and made it clear that a strong league and a healthy game is in everybody's interest. And I do believe perhaps more than ever before, there's a sense from the managers, from the clubs, that you have to put the game first. And I think the managers do that extraordinarily.
Sure.
Having said that, there isn't one person in that room who isn't there because he wants to win, and he wants to win it all. And that's what makes the game great. Speaking of which, winning and winning it all, have you been following night after night what's going on in the game? It is extraordinary. You know, out west, it's like the playoffs to get into the playoffs. 10 points separate teams 5 through 13. Big game tonight. Edmonton and Nashville are tied for the seventh spot with 71 points, and they're both playing. Edmonton's playing Atlanta, and Nashville's playing the New York Rangers. And then there are three teams, Minnesota, Dallas, and Anaheim. They're tied for ninth at 70 points, 1 point back of Edmonton and Nashville. And Minnesota's at Colorado tonight. Dallas is home to Carolina, and Carolina is in its own playoff battle in the East. And then there's St. Louis, which is only 3 points behind Edmonton and Nashville, and they're playing a huge game at home against San Jose.
13 games, and as I look at them, and I listen, the fans of the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Toronto Maple Leafs should watch the heck out of that game tonight, but it's the only one that doesn't have some kind of standings implication of the 13 games tonight. 12, and even if the Boston Bruins are trying to finish first overall, they're at home to Ottawa. Washington and Philadelphia are still jockeying. The Flyers aren't a sure bet to be in. They want to hold down four. So if you look at all of the standings and all of the games, 12 of the 13, there's something meaningful at stake in the standings possibly for each team.
No question about it. And while we just talked about the West and you transitioned us to the East, there are 6 points in the East separating teams 5 through 10. And the two teams on the outside looking in, the Rangers and Sabres, are both playing tonight. The Sabres are hosting Florida, which is just 1 point ahead of the Rangers, and the Rangers are in Nashville. It is simply, when you're looking at competitive balance, it is absolutely incredible. And all of this is going on with exactly 1 month left in the regular season. Who would have thought that the races could be this intense and this exciting? And I also think what you're seeing is teams, no matter how well they've been playing at any point in the season, even the teams like Boston or San Jose or Detroit, Washington, they have all gone through soft stretches.
Yeah, sure.
And so it looks like once the playoffs begin, it's anybody's race.
To me, it sure is in the East. I think any one of the eight teams that makes it could come out of the East. I see the West as being some powerful teams near the top. San Jose, Detroit, Calgary, and Vancouver would be my dark horse. But I think the...
Oh, so you mean only four out of the eight?
Yeah, that's right. Only four of the eight in the West.
And by the way, I wouldn't write off the other four.
No. I'm not going to write them off, but at some point somebody says who has a chance in the West. The phone number is 877-645-6696. We're getting ready to go to the phones. One more question about the Florida meeting, or do you have something else?
Well,
over
I have
there?
A couple of other things I'd like to talk about.
I forgot. Yeah. We're going through the shameless part of the show.
No, I'm not promoting anything.
Okay.
First of all, just it's worth noting that Marty Brodeur is two victories away from tying Patrick Waugh's records for most victories by a goaltender, and the Devils are home to the Coyotes tonight. And once he ties that record, which I guess he can do if he wins tonight, he can tie it in Montreal on Saturday night. And once he ties the record, I'm going to start going to all the Devils games, no matter where they are, because I'd like to be in the building when he breaks the record.
I'm not going to guess that you're going to have to wait too long. Just the way, as good as the Devils are and as good as Marty is, that...
Well, but nobody, you know, there are a lot of... Goaltenders in particular are very superstitious, so you got to watch what you say.
I'll leave that up to him.
Two other notes. Jimmy Gregory, as I think everybody knows, was taken ill. Our beloved senior vice president of hockey operations, been with the league, I think, for 5 decades, former general manager of the Leafs, had a heart attack and collapsed in the NHL office. He is doing much better. He still has a long road to go. I actually spoke to him on the phone this morning.
Did you? That's awesome.
We wish Jimmy and his family nothing but the best on his road to recovery. And, of course, we have to send our condolences again to the Howe family on behalf of the league and hockey fans everywhere on the passing of Colleen Howe. If Gordy is Mr. Hockey, she was certainly Mrs. Hockey, and our very best and deepest sympathies go to the Howe family. We can talk about the GM's meeting, or we can wait and do that with Mr. Campbell.
Okay.
Or we can take calls.
We got,
it's your show. What would you like to do?
I'm looking at this board in front of me that's flashing crazily, so I would say let's get to the callers.
Well, let's go to the callers. First up is Scott in Michigan. You're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM 204, Sirius 208.
Good afternoon, guys. I think this is the first time ever being first off on a show, so thank you. Couple of quick questions. One, there doesn't seem to be a Thursday that goes by that somebody doesn't say something about the job that Bill and Gary Thorne did televising games. And I wondered, having said that, Mr. Bettman, if you could take on an assignment to somehow have Bill and Gary televise the Winter Classic games on New Year's Day.
That's an interesting thought, but I don't get to make that call.
Not at all.
The broadcaster of the Winter Classic decides what talent it would like to use, and NBC has a terrific group of people who televise the game, starting with Doc Emmerich, although this year he had laryngitis. We get to consult, but in the final analysis, it's up to the broadcaster to take the people from its stable of talent to broadcast the game.
Scott's got my vote.
Yeah,
thank you, God.
Hey, that's why you do. That's why you do work for us on the NHL Network. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's all good, and it's good to hear Bill back on the televise, you know, on the games again. And my other question too, real quick: where do the team names like the Thrashers as being a new team in the league? Where does the team name and the logo? How does that process work? And do you or does the league have a lot of input, or is it really only the owners group that would put that together and their marketing people? How does all that come together?
It starts with the owners group, the local people, their marketing people. They create a concept. They explore all of the options. They ask for our input, and ultimately we have a right to approve it. But the logos and the team names really are the responsibilities of the team owners when the team comes into the league.
Have you ever had a proposal that you didn't approve of?
No, but there are some changes I probably should have disapproved. Most notably, and truth be told, I was very skeptical, to say the least, when the Islanders went to the Fishermen.
Oh, okay.
But I apologize to whoever I offended with that, but I know there are a lot of Islander fans who agree with me, and I probably should have gone with my instincts. Although, our standard of approval isn't, if it's something offensive or inappropriate, the fact that I might not like something or our marketing people at the league might not like something, we don't generally substitute our judgment for the people who are paying the bills for that franchise and are charged with doing it.
You're not going to veto something just on a difference in taste.
Right, because, you know, my taste may not be as good as the person who's doing the creation and is paying to have it done. One note before we take the next caller. My reference to Marty Brodeur, if Devils win tonight and he's in goal and he happens to win, possibly tying Patrick Waugh's record on Saturday night. New Jersey playing Montreal will be on Hockey Night in Canada, and it will also be, that's on the CBC, obviously, and it will also be on the NHL Network in the United States, and that's on Saturday night.
By the way, the Thrasher is the state bird of Georgia.
It is.
Right?
By the way, if you go through all of our names, they all make a lot of sense.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, there is a reason. It's not like the clubs get together or the people who own a particular club get together and throw darts. There is generally a reason, you know, why teams have certain names. Obviously, if you go back to teams from the original six, there's a long history and tradition. But with respect to the newer teams, absolutely, they will give you an entire marketing plan and focus as to why they picked a particular name. And I happen to like all of our names. I think they're all wonderful. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with any of them. At some point, I don't care about the names anymore, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't have to market them. But once they're in place and I get used to them, that's who they are. That's their identity. I'm okay with it. I don't think there's any one that's bizarre enough that I would go, what the hell were they thinking?
That's very good. I'm glad we passed the Bill Clement standard of sensibility.
I mean, there's not one that has me hitting my head against the wall thinking somebody was out of their mind when they named the team that.
What does have you hitting your head against the wall?
Things at home, but once I get here, everything's okay.
Oh, okay. Good. We won't
tell you, but I'd have to hurt you.
I'm not Dr. Phil, so we'll stop there. And what we'll do is we'll go to Tim in Minnesota. You're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM Sirius.
How are you doing, guys?
We're good. How about you?
Good. Pleasure to talk to you. Kind of neat to talk to the commissioner of the league. So, but hey, I got a question about suspensions and penalties and fines and or all. You know, I know it's been beat up, these headshots and stuff like that. What goes into what decisions are made? That's probably a good question for Colin Campbell. But, you know, like just for instance, Bugar got a 5-game suspension and a fine a couple weeks ago for, you know, I think it was an unintentional elbow to the head to Prust. But what goes into that decision-making, and do they take into account history of the player or how does that work? It just seems like it's all the way across the board. It doesn't make a lot of sense every time a suspension comes out for somebody.
Well, it starts with the fact that we have a hockey operations group that probably has over 150 years of experience, either playing, coaching, managing. And they watch every game that's being played as it's being played. And if there are things that happen in the game that they don't think are appropriate and really cross the line and require supplemental discipline, something more than just the penalty being called in the game. And in some cases, if they see something that wasn't called but they know it was inappropriate, they'll deal with it. The fact is, I can visualize the Bugard hit. There are some who suggest that he elevated, that he raised his elbow and planted it in the head of an unsuspecting player, and we protect heads. And our view is and the managers talked about this, we don't really need a rule change. You're not supposed to be targeting the head, and when you do, it gets punished, and that's why there was a 5-game suspension. I'm not suggesting that Bugard intended to hurt him. Maybe he even did it unintentionally, but the act itself was one that ultimately targeted a head, and it got a 5-game suspension. When you say that it's all over the lot, what frequently happens is people will look at two supplemental discipline situations and say, well, why was one way and one the other? And what I've said a little tritely, but I'll say it again, is supplemental discipline is like a snowflake. Every situation is unique. No two are alike. And it becomes a question of evaluating the actual act by the player, the circumstances in the game, how the players came together. The player's history becomes relevant to the extent that he has been disciplined previously from a supplemental discipline standpoint. If you're a repeat offender, you're more likely to be more severely disciplined than if you're not. But in the final analysis, these are judgment calls. It's not an exact science, but I think overwhelmingly, Coley Campbell gets it right. I'm extremely comfortable with the way he administers discipline for the game. And the Players Association has even said to us on occasion that they think he really does a solid job in handling the supplemental discipline.
What about the track record of the player or the history that a player has as far as the length of the suspension? It might not have anything to do with the incident.
It goes more to whether or not he's been disciplined in the past, whether or not he's a repeat offender.
Right.
I mean, you know, they understand and know how players play, and, you know, some players play more on the edge than others, but that really takes you more to evaluating the act itself. The fact is the punishment gets more severe if you're the type of player who's been repeatedly suspended, because it means you haven't been getting the message.
Got that part.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. Why don't we go to our next caller, which would be Keith in Toronto. Keith, you're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM Sirius.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. I wanted to chime in fighting a bit. I know it's been a hot topic lately. And I just wanted to say, if I was at a hockey game and a fight broke out and I was in the stands, I would be a lot less likely to stand up and enjoy and join in on the celebration. If the PA system in the arena didn't play some of the fight-related music that goes on and some of the visuals that are put on the Jumbotron after a fight. I think if the PA system remained silent and there was no, you know, cartoon video or whatever up on the Jumbotron that showed, you know, fighting or whatever, I'd feel very awkward standing up and showing my celebration. And I just thought that might be something that the league could do that would show their, you know, concern about fighting without actually changing any rules on the ice.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the suggestion. If I hear you correctly, you're suggesting that the way buildings use fighting in conjunction with music and video tends to encourage the fans. I don't think it encourages the players. My guess is when you're on the ice playing, and particularly if you're involved in a fight, you're not really focused on what's going on the video board or on the PA system. In terms of the fans, fans tend to react with a great deal of excitement and emotion when there's a fight in the building. And our teams, in addition to providing exciting competitive games, are in the entertainment business. And when people come into an arena, they want to feel the entire entertainment experience. I know a number of sports have been criticized for overdoing it in arena, but I think our clubs have been, for the most part, there are always exceptions, fairly judicious, creative, and entertaining in the way they run their buildings and their game presentation.
I don't know. I think maybe the gladiator atmosphere could push some player to some different level and make him want to fight again. But there's no way to prove or disprove it one way or the other.
But that also assumes that we're looking to influence fighting one way or the other. When Coley's here, we'll have the discussion of the fact, which I think most people and most of our fans feel, that fighting's a part of the game, and it always has
sure.
been. And it probably gets a disproportionate amount of attention from the media relative to its role in the game. I go to lots and lots of games. I don't think fighting gets a disproportionate amount of attention in game presentation. The physicality of the game might, but that's an essential element of what makes our game so good.
Speaking of Coley, is he up with us when we come back?
I believe he is.
All right. We're going to chat with Colin Campbell and get his take on the meetings from Florida that just happened this week when we come back to continue the NHL Hour right after this.
This is Vinny LeCavalier with Tampa Bay Lightning, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
Welcome back, everyone, to the NHL Hour. You're with Gary Bettman and Bill Clement. We're going to talk to Coley Campbell, Senior Executive Vice President, Hockey Operations of the NHL. For those of you who are on hold, callers, please hold on when we're done with Coley. We will get back to you. Colin Campbell, are you on the line?
Long time no see, Gary, like about maybe 20 hours.
I know. Do you miss me?
Yeah, I sure do.
Yeah, I'm sure. Where are you?
I'm in Jimmy Gregory's hometown. Passing through Jimmy Gregory's hometown.
What's Jimmy Gregory's hometown?
Dunville, Ontario.
Are you driving while you're talking to us?
Yes. Is that allowed?
I think you should pull over.
Okay, we'll pull over here at a Sobeys Mall.
Sounds good. Hey, Coley, we just finished the general manager's meetings. Why don't you talk to everybody about why we have the general manager's meetings and what you have to do to prepare for them, since it's your responsibility to put them together and run them?
Well, the general manager's meetings occur three times a year, and the meeting at this time of year, it goes on for 3 days, and it covers a lot of items. Most of the items our agenda items submitted by the general managers, various general managers. And they submit them. We ask them 2 months in advance to submit their items. And a lot of them, are late. But we do our work on a nightly basis in the video room in Toronto, trying to grab examples of certain items they might submit if they've asked us to look at a different type of icing call that's being used in Midwest Junior B League. We'll get some tape from E.J. McGuire, who scouts that league down there. We look at hits to the head. We'll grab various tapes and examples. We did a lot of work on the fighting topic, as did Gary Maher, who probably put in 2 months of work in examining every type of every type or kind of fighting. So there's a number of things that we do in preparation for this meeting. So the managers have a lot of information at their fingertips. Part of it is looking at the history of certain rules and certain aspects. For example, again, fighting, all the rule changes that have taken place. And Bill, you'll remember over your career, and our careers probably mirrored each other, from the bench emptying brawls, which they put a halt to, third man in, instigator, a number of things that we looked at and reminded the managers that had taken place over time. So there's a lot of work in preparation for those general managers' meetings.
What was the discussion like, since you touched on it, on the issue of fighting? It obviously was front and center from a media standpoint after the Sanderson tragedy. What was the discussion like and about, and how do you characterize the conclusions that the managers reached with respect to the role of fighting in the game and what, if anything, should be done with respect to it?
Well, Gary, you know that we were a little bit alarmed over a trend that was taking place well before the Sanderson incident that happened in that league in Canada. And that trend was the part where a player who threw a legal hit usually got confronted. If he didn't get confronted, he got jumped with a player trying to right a wrong, which he thought he might have been wrong. You can perhaps understand if it was a dirty hit, but any hit now, almost any good hard hit, almost brings a confrontation, and whether the player jumps you, confronts you, demands you to fight to answer that hit. And it was an alarming, I guess, trend that just picked up steam. And for why, I don't know why. We looked at that aspect. We looked at the stage fighting, if that's the proper categorizing of it. Stage fighting, which would be two players just deciding, hey, we got to settle something right off the bat. And as time goes on, as life is, we were trying to rack our brains. Billy may remember this. I think there was a time where that was not allowed in our league. You almost had to give it about a 10 Mississippi count up and down the ice and prove you could skate a little bit before you could fight or did fight. So we looked at that. We looked at a number of issues. We looked at the trends. We looked at the aspect of the helmet coming off, the obvious aspect of the shield. We have probably 60%, and it's growing every year, players who wear shields. So what do we do with a player who fights with a shield? That's becoming an issue, and we never really did solve that. It's a compounding question. How do you solve a player who has to fight because he thinks it's time with a shield, i.e. see, you know, Mike Richards from Philly or Jerome McGinley, who feel it's their time to do it, even though their managers may not want them fighting, and they'd rather, you know, be on the ice. They worry about injury. They don't want to lose a player for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. So there was a number of issues that we looked at in fighting, and I think the managers, first of all, were not happy about the stage fight. Felt there's a better way for those types of fights to take place. And also we talked about calling the instigator, applying the instigator more as the rule book reads. When a player decides to take upon himself to respond to hit, whether it's legal, whether it's illegal. If it's illegal, the referee will deal with it. If it's way over the line, we'll deal with it in supplemental discipline. But I don't know what happens to the old take a number, figure it out, and if you decide you got to make a wrong right, then do it in your own time.
There was a lot of discussion about the role of fighting in the game and use of words like accountability and thermostat on the game. Would you talk about that, how you see the role of fighting, and comment on the fact that while there was a lot of general manager hockey experience from the playing days in that room, as among you, Chris King, who is in the room, who works for hockey operations, and Paul Holmgren, we had three people who've engaged in excess of 300 fights in the course of their career. Would you talk about the dynamic, both of the discussion on fighting and the role of fighting in the game?
Well, first of all, Gary, I wouldn't call mine as fights. Mine were kind of hugs.
Well, that makes two of us. We got that much in common, Coley.
I didn't really like the part where you got hit in fights, you know. So, but there was a lot of experience in that room when it came to playing, and I think Chris King was second amongst all-time fighters, right behind Donald Brashear. So Chris has had a lot of experience, and he was part of the group that did the research with Gary Mahar, and they did extensive research, as I said before, and I think that, you know, it was a good group to tear apart the aspect of fighting, and none of our managers were squeamish, and they understand it has its role in the game, and you know, all due respect to the Sanderson incident, hockey has been played for a long time, and we feel that our league's as safe as it can be with the controlled hitting we have and fighting we have with four officials on the ice now. I think it's as safe as you can be with what goes on. And I guess, you know, it's not great for us to counter comments by players, but I was a little bit of taken back by George LaRocque and the player in Edmonton who criticized our managers about what they said or did with fighting. As you said, I think our group has got experience, you know, right back to Glenn Sather, who covered the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now the millennium, and they know what they're doing, and they care for the game, and they're a good, responsible group, and I think they know what they're doing when it comes to this topic.
So, Coley, is it safe to say there's a good chance that there will end up being a misconduct penalty handed out for one of those stage fights, and that there will be more instigators called if somebody does come in to avenge what was a clean hit?
I think you're right on. And I, in fact, after we look at this with the competition committee, and I'm not even so sure you have to design a new penalty. I think we talked about this with Stephen Wacom. I think there's applications in the rule book and interpretations where you can apply those applications and interpretations through fighting. And we're heading that way. I think the most important thing is now for a manager to go back and talk it over with their staff, with their coaches, think about what we talked about for 3 days, and we're meeting again in the finals in June, and I think we'll bring it to a head there, and then we'll take what recommendations that group has to the competition committee. From there, it'll go to the Board of Governors. So I think you're going to see a change. I don't think the group had any appetite to get rid of fighting totally. They understand where it sits in our game and understand it. You know, call it a release valve, call it what you want. But they were more concerned about the fact that when two players were really mad at each other, then they had a fight. Not that it was staged or it was thought about or talked about or planned from the game before. And you know, the one part that I think, you know, the rules that have changed in the game, I think, have been good when it comes to fighting. We looked at the fighting late in the game where we never, and, you know, I very seldom you ever find a good fight in the last 5 minutes of a game, and it goes on forever, and it's message sending and it's payback. And when we came out of the lockout, we added a instigator. If there was an instigator in the last 5 minutes for a player wanting to start a fight, wanting to send a message, we suspended him automatically for one game and fined the coach $10,000. And we went from before the lockout, 24% of our fights occurred in the last 5 minutes of the game. Now 4% of our fights occur in the last 5 minutes of the game. So I think that part, that rule change was good, and it wasn't meant to attack fighting. It was meant to attack stupidity.
Well, we're talking to Coley Campbell, Senior Executive Vice President of Hockey Operations for the league. I think it's also worth pointing out, Coley, that not everybody fights, and that, in fact, a small percentage of our players do a large percentage of the fighting, And if I'm not mistaken, something around 50% of our games are fight-free. So it's despite the media portrayal in some quarters, this is not all about fights. It's really about playing hockey. Hey, Coley, did you notice a difference in having the general manager's meetings after the trading deadline as opposed to before?
Yeah, I noticed a much more relaxed meeting. We always thought it was good to have the manager's meeting a week to 10 days prior to the trade deadline. As you have made note of a number of times during those meetings, our guys would be leaving the meetings with their cell phone cocked in their arms. At this time, I think they're much more relaxed. There's not much a general manager can do after the trade deadline is over with other than worry about his team. And I think they were focused on the game, focused on the task at hand. I think it was one of our better meetings, if not our best meeting.
With respect to the meeting, there was one element that doesn't get much attention at all, and it's a tradition that you have taken extremely seriously, and that is one night during the meetings, the managers get together and honor a former manager, and this year it was Bill Torrey. Would you talk about that night, and in addition, talk about the new element that you added to that evening with respect to the hot stove format?
Well, I kind of stole it from our PR department. The last 2 years, our PR department has, in the Ottawa-Anaheim final, invited there were 6 to 7 Montreal Canadiens who had won 5 cups, and they had a night where they had a dinner, presented each Montreal Canadian old-timer players like Dickie Moore and Paka Rocket Richard, amongst others, with a miniature Stanley Cup, and they discussed the history and their era, and it was just fascinating. They continued the tradition last year in Detroit, and they were going to do the Red Wings anyways, but it turned out to be very convenient with Detroit being in the finals and people like Alex DeVecchio, Red Kelly, and Gordie Howe. So this year we added that element to our general manager's dinner, which we have on the Monday night, where we honor a former general manager, this year being Bill Torrey, and two present general managers have been around for close to 3 decades, Glenn Sather and David Poile, were part of the Hot Stove group, along with Harry Sinden, Bob Pulfer, Jim DeVellano, Lou Nanny, and Scotty Bowman, who was down there. The stories were fascinating, and as you know, Gary, we were sitting with Scotty Bowman and that group at our table prior to the Hot Stove discussion, and Scotty Bowman, he remembers a shirt he wore at practice in 1959. So Glenn Hall and the Jacques Plante stories, they were just fascinating. I could have listened all night to those stories they were telling.
And you're not exaggerating about Scotty's memory. Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll let you go. I get calls a lot trying to explain to people who want to know how you administer supplementary discipline. I assured everybody you don't throw darts. You have a good reason for everything you do and all the decisions you render. Would you just, from firsthand, give people a sense of what goes through your mind and what the process is in deciding whether or not a player needs to be punished beyond what the officials may have called in the course of a game?
Well, first of all, Gary, as everyone knows, we monitor all the games, and we have a staff in there on any given night. Tonight we'll have close to 10 people in there because of the amount of games. And we'll pull a couple guys. Billy knows E.J. McGuire and one of his scouts, Chris Edwards, who is one of our central scouting people when we really have a busy night amongst with our regular guys. And when we have a situation when we see in these games, we'll look at it, and first we'll say, you know, is this something that requires our attention? If we feel it does, we examine it a little bit closer, wait for things to die down, look at the player involved, go back and see if any prior incidents had happened in the game, look at a number of criteria that we've established to establish whether this needs supplemental discipline, and look at a player's past history and if there was an injury on the play, was it a stick incident? Was it a high hit to the head, slashing? And so we've got a number of criteria, and we filter those things out pretty good. And when we finally decide it needs attention, whether it's a fine, whether it's a hearing, whether it's an in-person hearing and not one over the telephone, I usually make contact with the manager late that night, if not first thing in the morning. But usually we always want to make a decision prior to that player's or that team's next game. So usually it takes us making a phone call at night to the general manager. And as you know, Gary, those phone calls aren't always pleasant, but they have to be made.
Well, how do you decide whether to punish and how much?
Well, we look at our past suspensions. We talked in our, as you know, at the general manager's group meeting, we break off into four small groups and with seven or eight general managers. And in our group, we discussed the supplemental discipline. We discussed the length of games. Were they happy with the games we've been assessing? They've been fairly happy with the games. We'll run that by the competition committee, meaning the number of games each player gets. And we've got criteria over the past that we've applied to these players. So in cases of blows to the head, we're up over, you know, the last three or four instances we've had, we've assessed five games. We warned all players of all teams midway through the season that we were going to give more games. And if we have repeat offenders, we up that number. And so based upon, I think I probably handled close to probably over 300 to 400 instances since I've taken this job. And we've got a staff in there who's been with us probably as long as I've been there. So they're all pretty sensitive to what requires supplemental discipline and what category it might be. And it might be just a two-gamer, and it might be a 5-8-gamer, and then, you know, we've had the serious ones that, you don't have to be a Gordie Howe or a Sam Pollock to recognize those.
Coley, we're going to let you go. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. Drive carefully, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Bill. Thanks,
Gary.
All right,
Coley, thanks very much. You can get back on the highway. We know he pulled over, right? And listen, for the caller that called earlier, and for the people that think that the suspensions and the supplemental discipline is all over the map, it might be an inexact science, but there is a clear methodology that Colin Campbell and his staff go through to make sure that there is some uniformity given the grayness of the inexact science.
And they're all different.
Yeah. Everyone is different. I think he does a fantastic job. Colin Campbell is one of the most interesting guys in the world because of the things that he has to deal with and the people that he has to deal with. We have to deal with callers. Those who are on hold, your patience will be rewarded when we come back. Those of you who would like to chat with Commissioner Gary Bettman, 877-645-6696. The NHL Hour will continue after this.
Hi, this is Patrick Kane of the Chicago Blackhawks, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
Welcome back, everyone. Gary Bettman with Bill Clement, who likes Steely Dan but doesn't like that song.
No.
Although it's ironic because don't lose that number, and we're now going to go to our callers because we've got some people who've been holding on for over 40 minutes, and they didn't lose the number, so we're going to get right to them.
Nobody named Ricky, but it doesn't matter.
We'll take Ed in New Mexico. You're on with Bill and Gary, XM and Sirius.
Oh, hi, Gary. Bill, how are you today?
We're good. How are you?
Before I ask my question, I'll just say 2 weeks ago I had a stent put in my heart, so I have a lot of empathy for Jim Gregory, and I wish him the best in his recovery.
Well, thank you for that, and we hope you're doing well also.
I am. Thank you. My question is kind of a follow-up to a conversation we had about 3 weeks ago, and that is, has there been any movement on the contract discussion between Madison Square Garden Network and Center Ice as far as getting the high-def broadcasts put back on Center Ice this season or failing that, at least guaranteeing they're going to be there for next season.
We continue to work on it, and I promise you when we're successful, you'll know because the games will be on center ice in high def. That's something we're working on, and I hope in the not-too-distant future to be able to get everybody who gets the center ice package the MSG high-def feeds.
Well, I appreciate that because if you look at some of the boards out there on DirecTV and the DBS Talk, you'll see that there are, of course, thousands of fans of Rangers, Isles, Sabres, and Devils who are kind of miffed that those games disappeared on the 21st of January. So we appreciate the effort to get that resolved.
I feel your pain. I also have the center ice package, and I know what the issues are. But thank you for calling, and you feel good and take care of yourself. Chris in Philly, you're on with Bill and Gary, XM Sirius.
Hey, Mr. Bettman. How you doing?
I'm good. What about you?
Mr. Colento, how you doing? I'm good. Just a quick question about the NHL Network.
Sure.
Why don't the U.S. viewers get the certain games, like only Canadian viewers get them?
Well, what we try and do is put as many games on as possible that don't have to be blacked out. We don't want to overlap with the game that we're carrying in the local market, and so we'll try typically to take a game that we can show without having to deal with any of the blackouts. So frequently we'll bring Canadian games down, like Hockey Night in Canada on a Saturday night. And there are some games that we'll put into Canada that we won't put in here. But the combination of Game Center Live on NHL.com, Center Ice, and the NHL Network, if you're getting all three, you can see just about every game that you want to see. We can also go to another caller. We had a hat trick of callers holding for 40 minutes. Anthony in Connecticut, thanks for holding for 42 minutes. You're on with Bill and Gary.
Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I just have a comment and a question. My comment is I spend a lot of money on hockey tickets. I buy a lot of merchandise. I'm one of your favorite people, Gary, trust me. You know, when holiday season comes around, I buy a lot of NHL stuff and I go to a lot of games. And you know what? I get really insulted when people say that because I like fighting and hockey that, you know, I'm just a barbarian and that's all I like. And, you know, if they took fighting out of the game, I would still go. My point is that there's 100 things I love about hockey, but fighting is a very important part of it, and I really do enjoy it, and I'd be very angered if you guys took it away. That's just my comment.
By the way, stop before you ask the question. Most of the people who are associated with the game on and off the ice and most of our fans feel the same way that you do. It is a part of the game. As Coley talked about it as well, and as I mentioned before, it goes to accountability. It goes to a thermostat on the game. It goes to keeping acts of violence and the temperature of the game under control. And to be perfectly honest, it's a small part of the game, but it is an important part of the game, and it gets a disproportionate amount of attention.
I agree with you completely. And as far as my question goes, you know, I go up to Hartford a lot for the Wolfpack, which is the Rangers farm team up there. And, you know, they get 7,000 to 8,000 a game on the weekends, and they're a passionate fan base up there. A lot of them from the Whaler days will not support a Ranger affiliate. They still want the Whalers to come back someday. I know this may be beating a dead horse, but I know you spoke with Eddie Perez, the mayor up there. He recently got in some trouble. Gary, if there was a new arena up there for the University of Connecticut basketball, and if things worked, you know, worked out, is there a chance that Hartford could ever get the NHL again? And I thank you guys.
Oh, thank you. I hope, I'm certain, actually, it's not that I hope that Mr. Perez's troubles had nothing to do with meeting with me. Why are you holding your hands up, Bill?
I ain't going there. I wasn't at the meeting. I know nothing.
not to worry. And the mayor was talking about the possibility of building a new arena for the University of Connecticut and was hoping that somehow we would put Hartford on our radar screen. We're not looking to relocate. We're not looking to expand. Obviously, if either of those things were to change and Hartford were to build a new building and there was somebody who wanted to own a team there, it would be something we'd have to look at, as we would look at the many other options where people have expressed and cities have expressed interest in getting an NHL team.
I think I heard you say you're not ruling Hartford out.
Nothing's been ruled out. Nothing's been ruled in. And because we're not doing anything on that subject of moving franchises and putting them in new places. Because we've now taken a number of calls, we have our fourth caller who's held on for 40 minutes, and we are grateful. John in New York, you're on with Bill and Gary, XM 204, Sirius 208.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. And how about you?
Okay, I'm really excited. I'm flying to Pittsburgh tomorrow to see the Penguins play the Senators and Bruins this weekend. They're going to start an 8-game homestand. And I've been a fan for 18 years, so it's my first time going there.
Yeah, well, awesome, and thank you for being such a fan and holding on for 42 minutes to talk to us.
You're welcome. I wanted to talk about the playoff matchups. If the playoffs were to start today, the Penguins would play the Capitals, and I know as a commissioner you can't root for any specific matchups, but wouldn't you be thrilled to see a Penguin-Capital first-round series?
I'll be thrilled at all of our first-round series. Actually, though, there's a history of the Penguins and Capitals playing lots of playoff series
over
the years. They've always been intense. They're exciting. There are a lot of fans that drive between the two cities to see the games. And having, obviously, Crosby and Ovechkin facing off against each other will create an ongoing level of interest in that rivalry. And what people say, and I think it's true, a lot of our great rivalries emerge from matchups during the playoffs, and I have no doubt that if these teams were to meet in any round, it certainly would create a great deal of excitement.
Especially in the conference finals.
What are you rooting for? Are you predicting or just rooting?
Oh, you know what? I got so much going on that I don't even root for matchups. It's too. I know broadcasters that say, "Well, where are we going to be? We're going to be here. We're going to be." I say, "Wait, don't even waste your time. Start thinking about it 48 hours before the season ends."
Well, especially when you, as we discussed before, when you look at these regular season races for the playoffs, it's changing night by night.
Exactly.
We get a printout every day that shows what the standings are, how many games each team has left, who they're playing, how many home, how many away, what the tragic number is, and it's absolutely mind-boggling. Why don't we go to our next caller, Angela in Detroit. You're on with Bill and Gary. This is Sirius XM.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling.
Let me preface my comments / questions with I'm an ice hockey official. And there was a game, Detroit was playing Phoenix, and there was a call made by Don Van Massenhoven, I believe, on an icing. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are pertaining to the no-touch icing coming up. Not being biased or anything, I don't think that Dan Cleary put a hit on a guy from Phoenix chasing an icing down that was too vicious.
2 minutes.
By any means, was it any worse than any other hit during the game, and he was called for a penalty for it. I'm wondering what the standards are as far as what the referees are being told to call during those situations, things like that, and what your thoughts are for the no-touch icing potential in the future.
Good question, and I'm not in favor of no-touch icing. I know the managers aren't in favor of no-touch icing, and in fact, based on the conversations we've had at the competition committee, the players aren't in favor of no-touch icing. So we went to a different standard this year, though, to be a little safer and a little more protective, and that is, as two guys are going for a puck that may be subject to an icing call, they've got to be playing the puck. You can't play the body or the man to try and knock him off balance or keep him from getting the puck. It's got to be a play for the puck. And I think the question that was asked by the last caller was one of those plays where one player was actually going to get to the puck first and the other player was bumping him to keep him from getting to the puck. And that's exactly the call we want made to reduce the possibility of injuries and to avoid the need for going to no-touch icing.
See, you got me revved up as we have to sign off because I wanted to talk about the distinct kicking motion. We'll have to save that.
That's not anything to do with icing.
Nothing at all to do with icing. But the icing made me think of that.
We'll talk about it next time.
Why don't we do that? And folks, listen, if you're getting ready to watch hockey tonight and you have the center ice package, you got Florida, you got Buffalo playing together against one another. Unbelievable race in the Eastern Conference. You got Alex Ovechkin in action. You got Sidney Crosby. You got San Jose and St. Louis. The Blues are still alive. So tomorrow morning, if you wake up and you have carpal tunnel syndrome,
10.
You'll know why, and it will be a good thing. Enjoy your night of hockey. 13 total games, and we'll see you next Thursday at 4 Eastern on the NHL Hour.
For more podcasts, check out NHL.com. This is NHL Radio.